Hi, this is Mimi, and welcome to my podcast, The Lovely Becoming. Today's guest is licensed clinical social worker, Mina B., who's based in the New York area. I'm so excited for you to listen to our conversation.
Hi, Mina. How are you?
Well, how are you, Mimi?
Good. It's so good to connect with you.
Same here.
So tell us about yourself. What do you do? What do you love?
So I am a writer, a wellness coach, and a licensed therapist based in New York City. And my work is pretty much rooted in teaching people how to cultivate self-care through the lens of boundaries and community care. And one of the things that I would say I'm passionate about is community, as well as being in nature, reading books, and just taking care of my mental health.
I love that so much. I think it's important to think about, as everyone always says, holistic wellness and taking care of ourselves when we're doing work with other people.
Yeah, absolutely.
You wear a lot of hats as a therapist, a writer, a wellness coach, and educator. What boundaries do you create to ensure your own well-being?
So for me, I mean, boundaries are flooded in many areas of my life. So I would say the first thing that I do is I create boundaries on my time and how much of my time I can give. So I try to be very effective with my time management because I have so much going on that I need to ensure that I am creating space for me to not always be working. Mm-hmm. And doing things that I love and doing things that give me the space to rest and also pour back into my well-being. So I feel like that's where boundaries is the most critical in my life. Outside of that, I also like to make sure that I'm creating energetic boundaries on not only creating time, but how I utilize my time. So, I might not necessarily want to engage in certain things that feel work related during my downtime, you know? So I would say those are some ways that I create boundaries as a way to manage my well-being.
I love that. And thank you for making the time for this. I appreciate it. And I know that it's valuable because of your boundaries.
Thank you.
Yeah. I know you studied social work in New York City. How do you think that location and your systems framework help shape the work that you do now?
I never really thought of the location piece. And I do think that, I mean, it's New York, right? And it's the city. So that does take into account all the different aspects when we think of just like, I guess I would say like different classes, race, all of those different things. So NYU is located in Manhattan, of course, but I grew up in Queens, and I grew up in an area that is significantly different from Manhattan. I grew up in a very impoverished community. I grew up in a crime-ridden community. Seeing that shift from traveling to my community to Manhattan and being in like a wealthier environment, I think that played a role, as well as trying to have a better understanding of equality as well as equity, and recognizing how, you know, mental health, we're all impacted in many different ways related to our mental health. You know, in the communities that I work in, people's mental health generally is impacted, yes, by their own issues related to maybe depression and trauma. But when we get to the root of what's causing that depression and trauma, a lot of that has to do with coming from communities where they live in food deserts, or dealing with immigration issues, employment issues, right? Dealing with community violence. So I think that I wouldn't even say it was NYU that helped shape my systems framework. It was my own upbringing and my own exposure to having the privilege to be able to bounce around to different forms of communities and get exposed to how class affects everybody versus me only knowing my community, never leaving my community. So therefore, I just see the world through the lens of my community. I have the ability, and my family, was able to give me the ability to be able to go around and see the world and see different places, especially in New York City. So honestly, like, I don't even feel like NYU attributed to my systems framework. It really is just my own awakening into recognizing the community that I live in versus the communities other people live in, and recognizing that that too is playing a role in people's mental health being impacted.
That's good. I think a lot of times we think we need like a grad school education, and that's true for, you know, getting a degree and being able to ethically practice. But I think a lot of what we learn in our practices and in our work with other humans is just experiential, and being able to be present with other people in different communities and in different identities that they hold. And that's why I think too, like, we gain the most experience when we're seeing clients and when we're really engaging with them. So that's really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's really important. And I think that's why if you're someone who did not necessarily come from a specific community that had issues related to violence or issues related to food deserts, or you're exposed to a group of people who may have dealt with all forms of oppression, and you only see the world through one lens, I feel like that deeply impacts your work in a more negative way, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that, like you said, like, ethically to practice, we do need a degree, but however, the things that drive our ability to do the work generally falls outside of the programs that we studied, and it generally comes from lived experiences.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Jumping around a little bit, I'm thinking about socioeconomic status and different communities that we live in and access. I know we talk about on the podcast a lot about intuitive eating and about eating disorder recovery and having a team. I'm curious to talk and think a little bit more about what it looks like to access care in communities where there are food deserts and where it's hard to access nutrient-dense foods, et cetera, and what role that can play in kind of healing your relationship with food.
Yeah, I mean, it can play a huge role, right? Not being able to have access to healthy foods in the first place creates an environment where we have to rely on getting whatever we can get. You know, if we're hungry, we're going to eat. And I think it's not even just being a part of a food desert, also recognizing finances plays a role too, because even when you have the one layer where you don't have access to these healthy foods, but then you have this other layer when you do have access, the prices, you know, of some of these, depending on your location, the prices of these foods can be really difficult to feed a family of many people, you know? So personally, I do think that nutrition does play a role in managing our mental health. And when you live in a community, you know, even when I think of my community growing up, we have one supermarket and everyone pretty much shopped at the corner store, and everything at the supermarket was always expensive. And so there was a lot of fast food, though. There was a lot of liquor stores. There were a lot of corner stores. And then when you went into the supermarket, it in many ways too, and you think of a working family, sometimes it feels easier to just go to McDonald's and grab a bunch of different meals to feed your family, you know? So those are key elements into how our communities also play a role in the impact of our mental health. You know, and when you're struggling, especially with eating disorders or disordered eating, that can also have what you have access to nutritiously is also something that can definitely impact your health. And so I think, and then also, like, when you consider having to travel out, like, do you have a car? Do you have reliable transportation that will allow you the ability to travel out of your neighborhood to get access to healthier and finer things in life? So those are a lot of the different things where I find that isn't talked about enough, because we can push people to do better, but do they have the resources to do better? You know, because everything is not just a shift in mindset. everything is not just if you think better, if you change how you think, life is going to get easier for you. It's like, well, I can now get an understanding of what's causing my eating disorder or my disordered eating. But when it comes to having access, I don't have a vehicle. Maybe I'm unemployed or the finances I have aren't necessarily enough to feed a family. So I find myself feeling stuck. And when we even think about the systems, you know, a lot of people, I worked with clients in many different settings where I've helped them get access to things like food stamps and stuff like that. And that's even a hassle. You know, I think people assume that everyone's out here getting free food stamps. And it's like the work of even trying to apply and get a substantial amount to feed your family is also difficult. So there are so many complex layers to this that I think we also have to take those things into account as we work on our healing.
Sounds like there are a lot of barriers to well-being and care. And it's not as simple as kind of, I think we make it out to be. So sometimes we'll say like, oh, there's sliding scale options. And, you know, accessing that with a vehicle is really hard, or like having the internet connection to find which providers are offering that kind of thing. And so that's really interesting. And I think too, on that piece about going for fast food sometimes, like I think we have very much of a shaming attitude towards people's ability to access food. And I think there needs to be a lot more compassion and understanding around what we have and getting our needs met in the best way we know how.
Yeah, definitely, you know, because there are so many barriers, like you said, that creates these walls in regards to why people are not able to access the care that they're looking for. And I think, like I said, a lot of this work, especially like if you're looking at it through the lens of Instagram, it can look like, just think this way, do these journaling practices, do some meditation, and life is gonna get easier for you. And I think when we skip over the systemic issues that we're facing and the systemic barriers that a lot of people face, then it can still result in people feeling like, what's wrong with me? And so for me personally, I like to shed light on these issues as well, because it's not just you, it's not just your mindset. We also have to address inequality in many different ways.
That's really good. And I think social work definitely plays a role in addressing systems of oppression, whereas sometimes other forms of therapy can focus more on the individual, which everything has its benefits, you know, doing what you can as an individual to change. But I think it's important to think about what systems are at play in your life and what is affecting you too. Finding that balance between being able to make individual change and feel empowered, but also recognizing that, you know, you have to work within what we have.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Amazing. So switching gears a little bit, how do you respond to pushback on Instagram? And do you think it's feasible to say we shouldn't take it personally?
So when it comes to how I engage on Instagram, my mindset pretty much is that everything that I share is not for everyone. And so I am completely open to people disagreeing with me, just because I just feel like if my content isn't for you, then it's not for you. And that's quite okay. I'm not going to argue with someone to prove a point. You know, those are my own boundaries. I feel like that's what it has required, me developing boundaries on how I want to show up on these platforms. And so the first thing is, people are allowed to disagree. If you read my content, it's not for you, then it's not for you. I'm also open to learning. Tamia, you know, I read this post and I would like for you to consider XYZ. I'm open to having that type of dialogue, but I do think that one of the things I'm not going to do is argue with people on the internet. That's just not my thing, you know? So when I think of pushback, I'm thinking of it more from the lens of people looking to argue and also project, because this type of content does bring up a lot of emotions for people. And there are times where people will project whatever the they're feeling in the moment onto the post, and I'm able to read through that, because like, it's like, well, I never said any of these things. And so I'm not sure where any of this is coming from, unless this is your own internal response, right? That got triggered from my message. And that's not my work. That's not for me to carry. So I personally do believe that I shouldn't take anything personally via Instagram, because one, it's kind of like that confusing text message, right? Like someone reading someone's words versus actually having a conversation with them, it can feel like two different realities, right? But I also think that at the end of the day, whatever people share on the internet is just a reflection of them and their inner world. And so it's not really my responsibility to carry it, which is why I've been able to healthily get into a place where I don't take things personally that people share with me on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I think there's always pushback no matter what size your account is. And it's very interesting to consider like what is helpful for me in challenging what I say, but also what is, you know, we don't need to pay attention to that.
Right. Knowing the difference is what's important. Cause like I said, there's going to be times where people share something that's a little more enlightening, where it's like, oh, I didn't take this perspective into account. Thank you for sharing this in my comments. But you kind of know also when someone's sharing something that, you know, if it comes off disrespectful, if it comes off argumentative, then it's like, that's not what I'm here for. So yeah. We can agree to disagree, and that's okay too. I'm not here to change people's minds. I'm just here to share information. And if it's not something that works for you, there are many things that I read, even as a therapist, from other mental health accounts that I'm like, I don't see this perspective, mm-hmm. or I actually don't agree, but I don't feel like I need to vocalize that all the time. And I'm also not going to be argumentative to try to change the original poster's mind either, you know? So it's really all about, again, going back to those boundaries, and those are the ones I set for myself.
I love that. Yeah. There are times where I like see something I don't agree with, and I'm like, you know, I really don't need to take the time and energy to say something. And then there are times where, you know, if something's unethical or maybe needs to be pointed out, then that's a little bit of a different story for sure.
Right.
You write about friendships, and I know that I've been through friendship breakups. Can you talk about how to break up a friendship and kind of normalize that for our listeners?
Yeah. I think how to end a friendship varies. I think it really requires some sort of communication in knowing that you did try. Because I think it's important that when you get to a place in your friendship where you feel like certain things are happening, in any relationship, communication is key. So when it comes to ending a friendship, I assume that you've exhausted all of the forms of reaching out and communication that you can, because I think what ends up happening for some people is they feel something is happening, but they're not communicating. So therefore they're very quick to just put up a wall and say, this friendship is over. So I do want to normalize like giving tips on how to end a friendship, but I first want to say that you also have to put in the work. A friendship is also a relationship that you have to invest in. And so it's very important to ensure that you are vocalizing your needs in that friendship. It doesn't matter if you've known this person 5 years or 15 years, we can't assume that people know everything that we're feeling or thinking. It's important that we communicate those things. Now, there are going to be times where maybe you have done that. You have done everything that you can. And sometimes I find that friendships fade naturally. So the breakup happens through the creation of like distance. And so sometimes it's not necessarily me saying, hey, I don't want to be your friend anymore. A lot of the time we notice that the behaviors start to change and it creates this distance. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, especially if both parties are creating that distance and no one's advocating for the relationship anymore. That kind of is a sign that it is just naturally fading away. But in cases where for one party, it feels like you're trying to fade away, but for the other party, they're not allowing that to happen because they're still trying to keep the friendship glued together in some sort of way, then that's going to require communicating. So one of the things that I encourage people to do is try to engage in compassionate conversations that are not necessarily judgmental, but more so shifting and just saying that, you know, I feel like there are some differences happening between us and within our friendship. And so therefore I feel like, you know, maybe our season of friendship has come to an end, you know, something along those lines where it's communicated clearly and directly, because you also have to ask yourself, am I looking to create some distance in this friendship or am I looking to completely end it? And I no longer want to communicate with that person. And if that is the goal, I think it's really important to share that, or that person might continue to reach out to you and they're not sure why you're not answering or things like that. So it's hard. I want to start off by saying it's hard, but we have to do the hard thing. There's no easy way to do it. There are people who resort to ghosting, and ghosting is not necessarily a healthy way to communicate, nor is it effective or sustainable, you know? So I do encourage people, if you feel tempted to ghost, to really sit with that and think about the impact it might have on the other person. And I'm talking more so in friendships that are not abusive in any way. Now, if there's abuse going on, manipulation, all those things, you might have to use these tactics as a way to safeguard yourself from it. But I'm specifically talking about friendships that are just naturally starting to shift, and you feel like you want to take the easy way out by just disappearing instead of just saying, this is what's going on for me, and I think that our friendship has just come to an end.
Mm-hmm. That's good and challenging.
Definitely. I mean, I've had that experience where I found myself in a position where I had a long-term friend, where this is a friend that I knew since I was young. So as I got older, people change, people shift. And so therefore the nature of the friendship might shift as well. And I found that investing in the relationship felt very draining and tiring and forced. And so naturally, I started to just change my behavior in the friendship. And that was kind of like the starting point in recognizing that, like, you know, this is where the friendship ends for me, and me having to communicate that with this person, because I realized that although my behaviors were changing, they weren't catching on mm-hmm. to the fact that I was removing myself from the friendship. So, you know, I think it's really important. And I've also learned from that. Right? That was an experience that happened years ago in my early 20s, but I learned from it because I thought, had I said something, all that other stuff that continued to happen, where I felt like, you know, where all these emotions came up and all these things, that could have been avoided if I just communicated as well, you know? So sometimes people don't see the signs, or they see it and they're confused by the signs. And so they're pushy and they're doing all these things. And sometimes it just, it requires us to vocalize what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Communication is something that I have to work on, and I'm being challenged in this moment. But I appreciate that a lot. What are you reading right now?
I'm actually reading multiple things. I'm never reading like one book. However, the newest book I just started is What Happened to You by Dr. Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey. Mm-hmm. And so far, it's really, really good. I think that if anyone listening has experienced a trauma and they're still trying to learn how to heal from that trauma, I think that this is a great book on how to unpack it, mainly because the book is written in a conversational tone, where even for me as a therapist, a lot of trauma related books, I feel like, can be written too clinically. And so I feel like if I was a reader of it and you know, taking it in from a reader's perspective, not a clinical perspective, it might feel a little hard to digest. But I would say that if you are looking for something around trauma resilience, understanding your trauma, how it impacted you and how to work through it, this seems like a really good book, especially like since Oprah shares her story in it. So it's so conversational and so relatable in many ways because we have that story component. Then I think that it's impactful so far. So that's one of the books that I'm reading.
I love that. Yeah, I agree. I'm always reading many different things and I'm a book collector. I don't always finish the books that I get. So when you're writing a post, what is that process like to develop content and who or what kind of inspires you?
For me personally, my page already... The way I like to show up on my page is I have a very clear message that I want to send. So my messaging is often related to boundary setting, self-care, overall like mental health education that's specific to like community care. So I already have an idea of what I want to talk about. Because I mean, as a mental health page, there are so many directions you can go in, but I'm someone who I like to stay within a target niche because like, I don't want my content to be overwhelming, but I also know there are just certain areas that I'm really passionate about. And since my focal point is more so boundary, self-care, and community, I'm always trying to find content that's geared toward that messaging. I think the things that inspire me the most is one, my own lived experiences. There are times where I experience something and I'm like, oh, I want to write about this. So I feel like that does happen a lot. Let's say I experienced something over the weekend around like a boundary crossing or things like that. And my reaction to it will inspire a post. Mm-hmm. Another thing is the books that I read. The books that I read helps me with creating content. And also, believe it or not, culture, like the things that are happening in the world also does play a role in informing how I develop my content. You know, there's a lot happening in society. The pandemic, for example, you know, like there are many things happening in the world that I pay attention to that does inspire me to develop content because I'll see like an area where people might be struggling and I realize I can offer some sort of tips or information regarding a specific topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I think it's beautiful to be inspired by our own experiences as well. And I'm glad you said that because it's not always by other people and that's okay too.
Mm-hmm.
How do you practice being assertive in your communication with others in your own life? And how do you cultivate assertiveness?
So for me, practicing it is something I've developed over time and I'm still developing it. You know, so for me, it's really all about communicating my needs, but also being firm and confident in my needs. You know, I personally believe that assertiveness is also stemmed to our level of confidence and our self-worth. And I found that when I struggled with the relationship I had with myself, I often struggled with advocating for myself because I thought I either wasn't worthy of what I was asking for. I saw myself through the lens of how other people saw me. I didn't know how to cultivate who I was as an individual. And so those things impacted my ability to show up for myself. And that's what assertiveness is about, being able to show up for yourself, advocate for yourself through healthy communication. So one of the things that helped with cultivating that was one, doing the work of building my own self-esteem. And I did that through affirming my worth, right? Through maybe journaling practices, writing. Going to therapy also helped me with getting a better understanding of my own healing experiences and understanding my value, but then also shifting habits in my life that I found myself doing things that was associated with the lower points of my life. So when I struggled with low self-esteem, I may have tolerated certain things. And I realized that now that I'm elevating myself and now that I'm stepping into the work of healing, my habits have to change too. And that played a huge role in me learning how to be assertive because I had to advocate for myself in these relationships. So one, I find that you have to learn how to communicate clearly, which is something I did not know how to do. I was the type of person that I would like dance around the subject or like, you know, ramble and say a billion things just to say no, instead of just saying no. I was also an over explainer. And if the difference between explaining and over-explaining, I find that when we engage in over-explaining, it's generally when we're looking for validation from someone else. And for me, it was like, I can validate myself and my needs. So if I'm explaining something to you, it's just from a sense of courtesy where I feel like it's okay for you to have this information. But once I start to over-explain, where I find myself giving so many details of things is when I realize I feel like I have to unpack the whole entire story for someone to care about it and make sense of it and therefore validate my reasoning. And you know what's interesting too is being around other people who were not assertive started to like drive me crazy. And I was like, this is like a great experience for like around mirroring where it's like, do you do that? Do I do that? Is this how I'm showing up in my relationships? Because like, I wish you would have just told me no. Like, why are you sending me like a 5-paragraph text message when all you're trying to do is tell me no? So it's funny too, because for me to learn how to be assertive, I also started to realize the people around me who weren't assertive. And I started to pay attention to those behaviors that I realized like, wow, like I do that. And I'm realizing I'm frustrated by all of these people who are not assertive for a variety of reasons. And it made me reflect on my own behaviors because I'm like, well, I do that too. So I should be frustrated with myself, right? And so that helped me to have more compassion with myself and other people, of course. But I think that that was also a shift in how I was able to show up for myself and be assertive, because I also saw it through the lens of other people and I saw how it impacted me. I also saw how it may have inconvenienced me in some sort of way where when other people didn't have boundaries, it inconvenienced me because it's like, well, I wish you would have communicated that because we could have avoided all of this that took place. And it would make me reflect, what are you doing though that could put other people in a scenario? And I think that is also an eye-opening experience to learning how to recognize your own behaviors that you might see in someone else.
Definitely. Yes, I definitely relate, because I think sometimes when someone is doing something that bothers me, I'm like, wait, but I do that same thing too. And I don't recognize how terrible it can be. So that is definitely, this whole conversation has challenged me a lot. And I'm really grateful for that.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, I mean, like, this is work that I've done, but I want people to know I'm still doing it. You know, like, despite my clinical title, I'm still a human and I'm flawed. So there are times where I'm like, oh, I could have had a better boundary, or I could have been more assertive. So this is stuff that I'm still cultivating and practicing.
I love that. Yeah. A little bit of a fun question. What are your favorite foods?
Ooh, okay. Well, I am Panamanian. My family background is a cross between Panamanian and Colombian. So I am a major Caribbean food addict. I love jerk chicken. I love oxtails, plantain, rice and peas. Yes. Yeah, so that's like a big cuisine for me. I also like Spanish food, hence my background again. But outside of my cultural upbringing, I also love Asian food. I'm a big fan of sushi, and I also love Thai food.
I love it. I love it all. That's awesome. And a question I ask everybody to wrap up, and thank you so much for your time. How are you becoming?
I am becoming by doing the work of self-reflection, you know, paying attention to the different parts of myself that need nurturing and care as a way to piece myself back together.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for coming on and teaching us so much. I am so grateful.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.